April 22, 1945. Hitler, in his Berlin bunker, spent the entire morning asking about the results of the offensive that Steiner should have launched during the early hours of that day. Finally, at the midday meeting, his top advisors could no longer hide the truth and informed him that Steiner had been unable to launch any offensive. This news meant that Zhukov's 1st Belarusian Front would continue to concentrate all its efforts on the assault on Berlin, which, also under attack from the south by CONEF, would soon be closed in. Once Berlin was isolated, there was little guarantee that its weak garrison would be able to contain the Soviet advance towards the center of Berlin. Finally, the capital of the Rus was surrounded by April 24, from which point onwards a relentless Soviet advance began towards the central district of the capital, nicknamed the Citadel, where the main buildings of the German government and Hitler's bunker were located. On April 28, the Soviets reached the northern bank of the Spree River and were finally able to see the Great Reichstag building, in a similar way to how the Germans had opened the Kremlin in Moscow 3.5 years earlier. However, the difference was clear. While the Germans had seen the Kremlin with their last breath, the Soviets still had the strength and energy to continue attacking with great ferocity. Although the Soviets believed that the Reichstag was Hitler's main building of power and therefore the one they had set as a priority target, the truth was that since the fire of 1933 the building had not been used officially for any parliamentary session. In reality, the important government building was the Reich Chancellery, located about 700 meters to the southeast, which housed Hitler's bunker in its backyard. Another important building in the Citadel sector was the Kroll Opera House of the Ministry of the Interior, which was located opposite the Reichstag. Since the Soviets crossed the river just northwest of the Reichstag, these two buildings were the first to be encountered. Both the Reichstag and the Ministry of the Interior buildings were very solid stone constructions that withstood all the artillery shelling. In order to prepare the defense of both buildings, most of the windows and doors were boarded up with stone blocks or wood and sandbags were piled against the walls. Machine guns were positioned in the corner towers and above the main entrance were entrenched positions forming interlocking firing fields. Despite the heavy shelling by both the Air Force and the Soviet artillery that was beginning to launch against them, the thick walls absorbed the punishment without collapsing. This central government sector in Berlin would be the hardest nut to crack for the Soviets, as it contained the bulk of the elite troops still remaining in the capital. In the immediate vicinity of the Reichstag building was BFENSS General Wilhelm Muncke, who had been appointed commander-in-chief of the defense of the Berlin government district, nicknamed the Citadel. The main core of his forces was the BFENSS Guard Battalion of the Listandard, assigned to protect Hitler, which numbered about 800 men. They were joined by other units of the BFENSS, headquartered in Berlin, including the troops of Himmler's Guard, which numbered 600 men. Finally, it should be noted that there were also a few dozen French soldiers from the Charlemagne SS Division, who had been part of the shattered Orland SS Division. It should be noted that the rest of the elite units of the BFENS, including the rest of the divisions under the banner Rich, Totenkopf, Viking and Hitlerjugend, were in the vicinity of Vilna after their failed offensive in the vicinity of Lake Balaton and the subsequent Soviet counterattack. Russian officers on the northern bank of the Spree River believed that there were around 5,000 German soldiers in the vicinity of the Reichstag. However, in reality it was defended by no more than 2,000 troops. Of these, around 550 men were entrenched inside the Reichstag building, ready to fight in their final battle. One of the main protagonists in the defense of the Reichstag building was Lieutenant Buffen SS, Gerard Barbic, who commanded one of the banner companies, made up of 100 soldiers. Shortly before the Soviet assault on his position, Barbic received an additional 100 men from the depleted 9th Airborne Division, which was retreating from the Seelu Hills. In terms of heavy weapons support, Barbic had only two 88mm guns on the outskirts of the Reichstag and could also rely on the large 128mm guns of the flag tower west of the Tiergarten Park, which were about 2 kilometers from his position. Fortunately for the German lieutenant, he still had telephone contact with the garrison of this anti-aircraft tower. So on April 27th, the German lieutenant set up his command post in the basement of a ruined house behind the Reichstag and prepared for battle. On the other hand, Stalin had informed his two front commanders, Marshals Zhukov and Kev, that capturing the Reichstag would mean winning the race for Berlin. The Soviet forces of Zhukov's 1st Belorussian Front had reached the banks of the Spree River. Ahead of them was the Molki Bridge, which led them directly to the Reichstag, between the shattered buildings of the Kroll Opera House and the Ministry of the Interior, which the Soviets called Himmler's House. It would not be easy to cross the bridge, which would create a bottleneck that would cause heavy casualties, but they had no other option. The Soviet plan was to send a couple of battalions across the bridge, seize the diplomatic headquarters, and then storm the Ministry of the Interior with fresh forces that had already crossed the river. The attacking Soviet 79th Rifle Corps had 3 infantry divisions available. Each division had 2 regiments of 3 battalions, each with about 500 men per battalion. In addition, the 23rd Tank Brigade was also present to assist. In total, the Soviet assault force was estimated at least 10,000 infantry and about 80 tanks. The attack began with a thunderous barrage of Soviet artillery, using both artillery guns and rocket launchers, which shelled the area around the Reichstag before the infantry could begin crossing the bridge. It was shortly after midnight on the 29th of April that the Soviet artillery opened fire, followed by an infantry assault. By dawn, the best units of the 150th and 171st Rifle Divisions had entered the diplomatic quarter under direct fire from the 128mm guns in the Zoo Tower, 2 kilometers away. Despite its distance, the support provided by this anti-aircraft tower was vital, as it managed to destroy most of the Soviet tanks that attempted to cross the bridge. While the Russians were establishing their initial position south of the Spree River, the Germans counterattacked with the remnants of the 9th Airborne Division, which charged along the riverbank onto the Soviet left flank. Due to the weakness of the attack, in which barely 100 men took part, the German counterattack quickly stalled. Subsequently, the survivors of the 9th Parachute Division retreated into the interior of Reichstag. On the other hand, members of the Soviet 150th Division stormed the Ministry of the Interior, which, due to its large size and the tenacity of its defenders, could not be taken until the afternoon of April 30th. Although the German defenders were fewer than the Soviets had anticipated, resistance was much greater. Despite the difficulties encountered, Stalin wanted Reichstag to be taken before May 1 so that the red flag could be raised on its roof due to the strong symbolic meaning of that date. To meet this demand, the Soviets on the ground were forced to redouble their efforts. To this end, the exhausted battalions of the 150th Rifle Division launched an assault on the Reichstag at 7:30 a.m. on April 30, which was repulsed by the BFENSS troops defending the building. Earlier that morning, General Wilhelm Muncke himself had gone to Hitler's bunker to inform him that his men's resistance would only be possible for another 20 hours. After that time, the Soviets would reach Hitler's bunker. Shortly after the first Soviet assault on the Rog had been repulsed, the 270th Rifle Division was sent to capture the Opera Kraal. This attack achieved some progress, and in this action tanks, self-propelled guns and Katyusha rocket launchers were used to reinforce the assault. After the failure of the first assault on the Reichstag, the second Soviet attempt was made at 11:30 a.m. Unfortunately for them, the Germans also managed to stop it, although they were running out of ammunition. A little later, at around 1 p.m., the Soviets made a third attempt, which was also stopped in its tracks thanks to the help of gunfire from the anti-aircraft tower southwest of the Tiergarten. In the meantime, by 6 p.m., the Kroll Opera House had completely fallen into Soviet hands. Less than a kilometer away, Hitler committed suicide in his bunker at around 4 p.m. The final Soviet assault on the Reichstag took place at nightfall on April 30, supported by artillery and numerous tanks. Finally, one of the Soviet artillery shells managed to blow a hole in one of the Reichstag's bricked-up entrances, through which Russian troops began to pour into the building. What followed was a grim struggle room by room and floor by floor. A few hours later, a group of Soviet troops reported by telephone that they had reached the top floor of the building. A special banner with the Soviet flag was then dispatched, with orders to place the flag on top of the building before midnight at all costs. A small group of 25 soldiers, for their part, managed to place their banner on one of the damaged statues on top of the building, although fighting continued for several more hours on the lower floors of the Reichstag. The flag in the famous photograph, intended to compete with the one recently taken by the Americans at Ibojma, was affixed to the statue of the Goddess of Victory by Captain Makov and a group of non-commissioned artillery officers. However, these events were recreated in the light of day on May 1 for the Soviet propaganda services, and this was the photo that was broadcast throughout the world. This act did not by any means mark the end of the fighting in Berlin, which in some sectors continued until May 2. Regarding the German garrison led by Lieutenant Barwick, it should be noted that during the final hours of the battle inside the Reichstag, he and 100 survivors managed to escape from the building and headed north. Although their goal was to leave the city, they were eventually surrounded by the Soviets and surrendered on the morning of May 2. Finally, it should be noted that the casualties of the Soviet soldiers who stormed the Reichstag are estimated at around 500 and the Germans slightly less. While the battle for the Reichstag came to an end, a new race began to reach the bunker. Do you know the story of the first Soviets to enter Hitler's bunker? Was there German resistance inside? Berlin, 4 p.m. on April 30, 1945. Hitler has just committed suicide in his bunker located in the garden of the Reich Chancellery. This bunker had been Hitler's official residence since mid-February 1945, when he had to leave an apartment in the former Reich Chancellery and take up permanent residence there due to the intense bombing that the capital was suffering. As a matter of curiosity, Luftwaffe ace Hans Rudel offered to fly to Berlin for him on April 26, when the capital was already completely surrounded, and evacuate the German leader in his plane. This offer was rejected by Hitler a day after the German leader committed suicide. After finally realizing that the Soviets were not going to accept anything other than an unconditional surrender, Bells also committed suicide outside this same bunker on the afternoon of May 1st, when the Soviets were only a few meters away. During that night of May 1st, most of the personnel still remaining in Hitler's bunker, including workers, assistants, and generals, ended up leaving to participate in a night escape. In this way, during the early morning hours of May 2nd, only two men remained alive inside the Hitler bunker, along with the lifeless bodies of Kevel's sons and some generals such as Berdorf and Krebs, who had committed suicide in one of the bunker's corridors. One of the men alive inside Hitler's bunker was the famous radio operator and former bodyguard of the German leader, Rochu MIT. And the other man was a 36-year-old engineer named Johannes Hensel, who had stayed behind to keep the electric generator running. This generator was very important, since an underground hospital with thousands of wounded people that was near Hitler's bunker depended on its energy. With no one from the German government left inside the bunker, Rochus MIT decided to leave at around 4 a.m. on May 2nd to try to save himself, although he was eventually captured by the Soviets and held prisoner in Siberia until 1955. Hensel was thus the only man inside the bunker when daylight broke on May 2nd and, unbeknownst to him, although he was expected, he was to be the first and only German the Soviets would see when they finally entered Hitler's bunker. The Soviets, for their part, planned to carry out an assault on the Reich Chancellery during the early hours of May 2nd, using troops from the 5th Rifle Corps of the 9th Shock Army. The assault was eventually carried out through Wilgen plots and met with weak German resistance. Little by little, Red Army troops stormed the compound, and at this point the Soviets only knew that Hitler had been reported killed in Berlin on April 30th. According to the report that Goebbels had sent them the day before. A special unit led by NKVD Commander Anna Nikola and four male soldiers from the 1050th Infantry Regiment played a prominent role in this assault. Nikola wore a red Soviet flag around her waist and, together with her escort, fought her way to the top floor of the building and planted the flag on the roof. At almost the same time, at 0600 hours on the same morning of May 2nd, German General Helmut Wittlin, who was in command of the final defense of Berlin, made the official announcement about the surrender of the capital's garrison. However, many of the defenders who were precisely in this government sector, belonging to divisions of the BAFSS made up of foreign soldiers, such as the Norland Division, continued to fight. They were clearly aware that death awaited them in captivity. According to the testimony of the last man remaining in Hitler's bunker, around 8 a.m. on May 2nd, Hensel began to hear female voices that he knew from the language were not German. Then, when the German engineer left the room with the electric generators to see what was happening, he saw a group of Soviet female soldiers from a traffic management unit. The women rushed at him and demanded that he take them to Eva Braun's room so they could take her clothes. They also took many of Goebbels' wife's clothes and belongings. Once Hensel took them where they asked him to go and they stole the clothes of Hitler's recently deceased wife, the women forced him to put on women's clothing as an act of humiliation. When this shameful scene was over, the next to enter were women again, this time nurses who were looking for supplies for the wounded. Like the others, they also took all the clothes they could. A little later, between 9 and 9:30 in the morning, agents of the Soviet Political Police, also known as the NKVD, arrived to try to locate Hitler and other German leaders. This commando was acting directly under Stalin's orders and, As we will see later, not even Marshalikov himself knew of its existence. This detachment was led by Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Baddies, and the first thing they did was capture the German engineer so that he would guide them through the interior of the bunker. Since the Soviets did not trust that the rooms were not booby-trapped, Hensel was ordered to open each door and enter each of the rooms first. According to the German engineer's later comment, at that time there had been fires in several rooms, including Hitler's study room, which led the Soviet officers to believe that there might be explosives. In addition, they were also afraid that there might be a gas trap. Once Hensel had shown them several rooms and the Soviet officers saw that nothing was wrong and that the bunker was indeed safe, they sent the German out after asking him where Hitler was and cordoned off the bunker so that no one else could enter. From this point on, the Soviet investigators were left alone in the bunker and began searching everything for any evidence that would indicate what had happened to Hitler. Lieutenant General Alexander Baddies was under pressure from Stalin, who wanted to know everything that had happened to Hitler in detail as soon as possible. Despite reports of his death, Stalin seemed to believe that Hitler was still alive. When Marshal Zhukov showed up at the bunker that night intending to enter, Alexander prevented him from entering as Stalin had ordered him to do. The false excuse given to Zhukov was that the bunker was full of booby traps and too dangerous. However, Stalin was playing a double game by asking Zhukov to start his own investigation to determine what had happened to Hitler. As the search continued, a large number of Hitler's former staff members were arrested trying to escape from Berlin and were quickly taken into custody for interrogation. In order not to miss a thing, Stalin sent a trusted man to oversee each interrogation with a direct and secure telephone to Moscow, through which Stalin was given word-for-word details of what each of the detainees had said. The first to be identified were the two bodies found in the garden of the Chancellery on the same day, May 2nd. Examination by Soviet investigators revealed that the male body was wearing a leg brace and it was quickly established that it was Bell's. However, his head, although partially burned, was also quite recognizable. Added to this was the fact that several of the captured bunker attendants confirmed that the bodies belonged to Bell's and his wife. The case was closed almost immediately. Incredibly, Bell's children were not discovered until the following day. In this way, once they were taken to a makeshift hospital, a Soviet medical team performed the corresponding autopsies on them and determined that they had been poisoned. Although the Soviet investigations began to bear fruit, the most important thing was still missing. They still did not know what had happened to the people who had been in Hitler's bunker. They responded that they either did not know anything or that they had witnessed the suicide of Hitler and his wife. But even accepting the version given to him by the majority of these people, Lieutenant General Alexander needed to find the body. He did not believe the version that the body could have completely disappeared in a bonfire in the courtyard of the Chancellery. During the afternoon of May 3rd, in a large water tank near Hitler's bunker, numerous bodies were found that appeared to be hidden inside it, which made Alexander think that Hitler's body was hidden there. They quickly found the body of a middle-aged man wearing a dark suit and sporting the same mustache and hairstyle as Hitler. The following morning, in brighter light, the body was removed from the water tank and brought before six German witnesses who had previously been with Hitler. Five of them said it was not Hitler, and one said it might be because they did indeed look alike. This body attracted much Soviet attention and was photographed and filmed. The apparent cause of death was a bullet hole in the middle of the forehead, suggesting that the man had been executed. Subsequently, many suggested that the body was that of one Gustav Beller, who was none other than Hitler's double. Eventually, the investigation determined that this man was not Hitler and the body was destroyed. One of the Soviet colonels who was part of this investigation detail ended up finding the remains of two other burned bodies buried in the garden of the Chancellery during the daytime of May 4th and again raised hopes of finding Hitler. An autopsy determined that the female body belonged to a woman who matched all the physical characteristics of Eva Braun, although it was not 100% conclusive. Regarding the male corpse, matching it to Hitler's was also quite complicated. For example, the autopsy revealed that the male corpse was 163 centimeters tall. However, Hitler was 174 centimeters tall, which made a difference of 11 centimeters in height. This height difference is often explained as the effect of fire causing bodies to shrink. However, there was other evidence that did not fit with the existing data on Hitler. Due to pressure from Stalin, Soviet investigators tried to close the case as soon as possible and concluded that Hitler and his wife had died in Berlin on April 30. However, the idea that Stalin conveyed to the rest of the world was that Hitler had escaped. This version of Hitler's escape became the official version of the Soviet Union until 1968, when the Soviets finally admitted that Hitler's remains were under their control. The reason they were spreading the other version for the last 23 years was to reinforce their presence in all the occupied territories under the threat that Hitler would return under the umbrella of the Western powers. Well, now that we have seen how the Soviets entered Hitler's bunker and how the investigations developed during the following days, let's finally see what happened to the German engineer they found there. Once they got him out of the bunker, after having guided the Soviets inside, Heinel was imprisoned and later charged with sabotage. He was basically blamed for the fires that had broken out inside the bunker and for obstructing the investigation. After a 10-year prison sentence, the German engineer was released 4 years later, and it was then that he was able to start a new life in Germany. Finally, Hensel died in Aquisgrán in 1982. On the other hand, the radio operator Russ Mito in 2013, being the last living person who had personally met Hitler. Well, what did you think of the story about the Soviets entering Hitler's bunker? If you're interested in analyzing the final resistance put up by the last Tigers of Berlin, I'll leave you in the description the program we recently uploaded on this subject along with an interview we have with Daniel Ortega. Thank you all for being part of this community, especially those who have become members. Subscribe and share this program if you liked it, and we'll see you as always every Wednesday and Sunday.